The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bob has to decide between being a mercenary and hitman. He decides he would rather look cool than get shot at. Vint gets into Store and Forward, but does he become a boarder? And Ambipure gets past the FDA so your teeth are cleared for laser cleaning. And much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them. And in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Coming up on April 16th in San Francisco, Enlighten will have an all-day event featuring high-tech companies pitching to investors, panels and discussions on countering disinformation campaigns that are disrupting modern society. Sign up for San Francisco April 16th at eln3.com. This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Nathan, welcome back to The Cyber Show. It's been a while since we've heard from you. Give us the background, of course, on your company, name of it, and what you do.
Hi, Fred. It's great to be back. The company's Enamelpure. I'm Nathan Monti, the co-founder and CEO. Enamelpure is revolutionizing the preventive dentistry market by digitizing all of preventive dentistry with a unique laser and imaging solution.
So you're digitizing with the laser? You shoot the laser at it and it turns your teeth to digital? Or what exactly are you doing there? That was confusing.
So the laser cleans your teeth, replacing the ultrasonics and the picks and the spitting and the washing and the bleeding and the pain. And it also hardens your teeth to replace the fluoride treatments. And it also prepares your teeth for a new whitening mouth guard that we've patented. The digitization happens with the imaging, where we image your teeth and gums while your teeth are clean. So both happen at the exact same time.
Okay. So, you know, just for clarity, when I go into the dentist, the last time I went into the dentist, they scraped my teeth. They, you know, pick stuff out from between them. They did all sorts of stuff. That at some point, I think they all, you know, they thought about using the drill to smooth something, whatever they did. It smelled bad. It sounded bad. It didn't actually hurt. Well, my tolerance for pain is higher than many, I guess. So it didn't hurt too bad. But it took about a half an hour, something like that, right? 45 minutes to get through the process. And then they took their x-rays and they did the cleaning, you know, the circular brush cleaning thing to finish it off. So it's all polished. And when you lick your tongue on it, it's all smooth until you have something to eat, at which point it's rough again. So how does that change this process for me going to the dentist, and how soon will it change that process for me?
Maybe you don't realize it, Fred, but as we get older, our teeth are less sensitive. So the sensation is more in your 20s and 30s and 40s. So basically, you'd sit down in the chair. It takes 10 minutes. The hygienist doesn't have to touch your teeth. They can if they want to, or accidentally or on purpose. There's no harm done. And they just move the laser light around the teeth. No noise, no feeling, no spitting, no rinsing. And in 10 minutes, they've removed all the plaque and tartar on your teeth, under your gums, and in between your teeth. Very simple and straightforward process. If you want to have your teeth hardened so they last up to 10 times longer over your lifetime, you can spend an extra 5 minutes. The hygienist changes the setting on the laser, goes back over your teeth again in 5 minutes to harden them so that your teeth won't wear. And then finally, if you want to have your teeth whitened at the end of the hardening or the cleaning, the hygienist pops in a mouth guard. You wear the mouth guard home as you drive and throw the mouth guard away when you get home. That's how it works.
So, you know, this is a dental and medical type procedure, right? So medical and dental type procedures, before you can sell them to the dentist, you have to go through some sort of an FDA thing, right? So tell us about that FDA thing and what you have to go through to do that.
Yeah, sure. So for the FDA in dentistry, we use extracted teeth because enamel is a dead tissue. There's no blood flow to it. And then we have a saliva model, it's called. We dip the extracted teeth in the saliva model for 2 hours, and then we process the teeth. We did 4 sets of bench trials, bench tests for the FDA. We filed in the end of December. We received our 510 FDA clearance last week. 3 months and 3 days later, we did have 4 questions. We successfully answered them, and it's the fastest clearance I'm aware of, Fred.
So as I understand it, effectively, this means you win, right?
That's correct.
So at this point,
really, I mean, everybody wins, Fred, right? So you go to the hygienist, and it's just much better experience. Plus, your teeth are finally completely clean, and the laser kills the bacteria at the same time, which helps you prevent gingivitis long-term as well.
Well, when I say you win, I guess what I mean to say is you're done with all of the governmental stuff that you need to start selling this, right?
That's correct. So at this point, we're a little surprised to receive clearance so quickly. We were expecting it to take more like 4 to 6 months. But we've just ramped up our manufacturing at a contract manufacturer, and we're onboarding with the first and third largest dental distributors in the United States.
So game over. You there's no competition that can do this. You can sell it to anybody in the United States. It's all cleared to do this. All you have to do is convince the big distributor houses to buy it from you and then somehow manufacture it. So what's your situation in terms of manufacturing and distribution?
We've built similar products before. So the manufacturing portion is very straightforward. We know the people at 2 of the local medical device contract manufacturing companies. So that's relatively low risk. There's always supply chain risks, but we use fairly standard components, so nothing exotic. So that's minimal as well. The Henry Schein, the largest dental distributor, not only in the United States, but also in the world, and they're in 33 countries. And then Benco, which is a smaller company located all along the East Coast, both have a new customer and new product introduction phase. So we're signing the legal documents for the distribution, and then we'll ship some units to their key opinion leaders, KOLs, and work our way through the process of qualifying us and the product.
So my understanding then is, well, when you say qualify, I mean, basically these people are pretty close to buying, right?
Yes, that's correct. We can start selling in the meantime. Talking to a number of DSOs, dental service organizations, and we'll place one unit in a local Massachusetts dental clinic and start getting real clinical reports back.
And you get royalties on this. So everybody that cleans their teeth, they give you what, $1.50. And if there's a million teeth cleanings, in the U.S., there's got to be 100 million teeth cleanings a year, right?
There's between 150 and 200 million teeth cleanings in the United States per year. And we charge a recurring revenue for the teeth cleaning, we charge a separate revenue for the enamel hardening, and a third revenue selling the whitening mouth guard. So at the cleaning will be somewhere it's between $3 and $5. You know, in Idaho, it's $3. In New York City, it's $5.
Okay, so we're talking about $450 million just for the cleaning per year if everybody adopts it, right? Because some people still want to scrape their teeth, right? And
well, it does take a while. Any market adoption has a ramp-up curve, absolutely no doubt. And we can only ramp up at a certain rate because, the contract manufacturer needs training of their employees, and the Schein and Benco both need training of their salespeople. So it does take time. There's inertia. But over the next few years, hopefully we're selling thousands of units, Fred.
So let's go back from the selling to thousands of units. So where I live, I have a dentist. How can I get my dentist to do this, right? To buy this first, you know, because frankly, you know, it's a competitive world out there. And I think everybody listening, you know, to the radio program is going to say, hey, can we get it at our dentist? So if we become like the place where everybody's demanding it, can we just, you know, get it in 6 weeks or a month or 3 years? How long will it take us to get it if we pressure our dentists, and how do we do that?
It'd take about 3 months, and that's just the manufacturing ramp up. Once we're in manufacturing, it's somewhere between 25 and 30 hours to build one. So 3 or 4 days after it's ordered, it ships. Contract manufacturer ships either directly to the distributor's warehouse or directly to the dental office.
Okay, so I have a teeth cleaning that's due, probably it's 4 months from now. Am I going to make it, or am I going to have to wait till the next one? And if I delay my cleaning, can I, you know, just fix it that way?
Yeah, you just have, we'll just check in 60 days, and then you can pressure your dentist. And if they're interested, we'll have somebody from Shine or Benco drop by.
All right. So what I'm going to do is next time they call me for cleaning, I'm going to be calling them for enamel pure, right? I'll just say, talk to whoever does your distributor, tell them you'd like to be first in the line because, you know, your patients are clamoring for it. Nathan, fantastic. Oh, and people can still invest in your company. We're not going to tell them the details here on the show. They can go to thecybershow.co and click on your link for enamel pure.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Rumor has it that artificial intelligence was partly to blame for the Israeli airstrike that killed 7 World Food Kitchen workers attempting to deliver food in the Gaza Strip. A tragic loss, we all agree. While this is not the first time AI has been attributed to the loss of human life, it is certainly breaking news on the Cyber Show. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com, that's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. In this segment, we're going to talk to Bob Monroe. Bob has a long history of being a hacker of one form or another, always in a legitimate way, always doing things in order to get the job done, so to speak. And of course, after he got out of his previous career, he started to work with Hacker High School to develop lessons that real people could understand. So when it comes to teaching people about cybersecurity and issues related to it, Bob is really outstanding. Here's Bob. When you got out of the Rangers, did you move on to Delta or?
No. One of my wife's friends, her husband was a pilot in the Army. Now, in the Ranger Battalion is run by enlisted. It's run by the non-commissioned officers of the Army, or it's
run by sergeants.
Run by sergeant, yes. When you talk to somebody who is one rank above you, you stand at parade rest and you call them, you address them by their formal rank. Like if I'm an E4 and you're an E5, I will say, yes, sergeant, and at parade rest. If you're an E6, I'll call you staff sergeant. It's just so the Ranger Battalion is extremely non-commissioned officer focused, and it's run by the non-commissioned officers. Well, I'd never met a warrant officer before. I had no idea other than they're gods. They walk on water. So this guy, he's a chief warrant officer 3, and he's flying this aircraft called the Mohawk, which is from the old Vietnam. It's a fixed-wing aircraft. And this guy, I mean, he's got the aviator glasses on. He's just cool as can be. And I'm just looking up to this guy like, this guy's a freaking rock star. So one day he pulls me aside and he says, you know, Bob, you just got married. What are you going to do with your life? I'm like, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. He goes, let's think about this. Let's talk this through. I'm like, okay. And he goes, okay, let's say you go through. You go and you become Delta Force. You become an operative. And he said, you do 20 years of that. Now, what are you going to do after your 20 years in the Army? What kind of skills can you transfer over to the civilian world? He goes, are you going to be a hitman? Are you going to be a mercenary?
By the way, those are two things you could do after that experience, right?
Very much so. Yeah, you can be a...
And is that a common path out?
Not really. Just because those jobs don't have a very... a lot of longevity to them.
So most of the people who go in that route don't make it out the other side.
Yeah, and that's kind of the... I want to say one of the downfalls of that is, you know, just like anything else, after you've had a career doing something, you want transferable skills. Well, the skill path that I was going down, I wouldn't be able to use it in the civilian world after 20 years. So this one officer says, okay, so after 20 years, you know, here are your prospects, and none of them are good. He goes, but, and he pulls out the Savannah newspaper, and he goes over to the want ads of it. And he opens it up and he points to wanted commercial airline pilot, looking for pilot. And he's showing me all these classified ads looking for pilots. And he's like, why don't we make you a pilot?
I'm like, no. Okay. Hey, Bob, want to be a pilot? Sure.
I'm like, I'm not smart enough, man. You got to be smart. And he goes, no, you're fine. You'll do just great. And So I said, okay, you know, like a little puppy. Okay, I'll follow you. And the hardest part about being a pilot is getting the paperwork and getting accepted into flight school. Flight school is a piece of cake.
Compared to the paperwork.
Yeah, the paperwork. Oh, my. And then the flight physicals and all the stuff, the vetting process that they do before you become a pilot is just phenomenal. They make sure... Just like any other program where they're going to invest a whole lot of money into you, they want to make sure that you're the right person to invest that money into. So there's a huge vetting process that goes to that. So sure enough, I get to the point where I've got two options. Either go to Delta or I get selected for flight school. So I weigh the pros and cons. The cons are Delta, I get shot at more, and I don't like getting shot at. The pros are I'd look good in a flight suit. So there we have it.
Okay. You're going to look good and not get shot at.
Exactly.
First thing you think, right? Because you do get shot at in airplanes, only they're things like missiles instead of bullets, but okay.
Yeah, but not as often.
So you mean as in you're not always ducking bullets, just every once in a while you're ducking missiles?
Yeah, on occasion.
Okay, so many things in there. So your choice is looking good or getting shot at.
Yeah.
I need to think about that.
As a kid in Colorado, I think, you know, at 10, 11, 12 years old, I took glider lessons, sailplanes. And I remember getting, you know, a little cocky about it one day. And looking at this now from my perspective at this age, basically, you know, there's a guy, tall guy who needed to shave, who's, you know, getting some flying hours, making $1,000, training some snot-nosed little kid like me. And we're doing the walk around. And I've done it so many times at this point that I'm feeling really smug. And I made some little offhand comment, you know, about the wing pins, like mechanics, how it was somebody else's responsibility. And this guy turned on me, you know, from the height of like 7.5 feet tall to my 2 feet tall. And leaned over and said, you know, the wings fall off. It's the pilot's fault. Words to that effect.
I shrank down. Well, not to mention that the pilot dies. The mechanic does not.
So, yeah, flight school, you know, and these high consequence training environments, because we talked about in the last segment, you know, the military training in the first place, you know, is a good way to learn, you know, how to get some things done. Do you get to the Ranger Special Forces level, SEAL folks, and these are folks who are really like a challenge, and go through flight training. You know, flight training, as he said, flight training was easy compared to the paperwork. It's like, be clear, folks, no, it isn't. But when you're like Bob, and you know, a lot of us crazy cyber folks, you know, you like the kind of challenge that forces you to figure out how to fly something that will kill you.
So there are some other things that I just really enjoyed about that. I don't know, it's such a pleasure to talk to him because he's so direct, and it's like, no problem here. You know, I'll tell you exactly what I think and who I am. No problem. interestingly, Merc or Hitman or Pilot, that didn't seem to be the decision, right? It wasn't that he was offended by, you know, becoming a mercenary or a hitman. You know, and Pilot looked good too, you know, but and then the paperwork, as you mentioned, but then the other one is, you know, they're investing a lot in you. This whole perspective that, you know, you're an investment for them. And so the reason they're doing all this checking is not because they want somebody who's really good. It's all about the investment. They're not looking for the best and brightest. They're looking for the best investment.
Yeah, a reliable asset.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes perfect sense from their perspective. But one of the things that means is being really, really good at it may not be the best investment, right? There are other considerations.
Right.
Right. Your capacity to maneuver the aircraft may not have the exclusive priority. For example, your willingness to fill out all the paperwork, you know, follow directions properly.
Right.
Right.
Well, yeah. Think about driving cars. My son, Damian Blass, my oldest, fantastic, best people on earth. Not that I'm biased, but, he's one of the greatest drivers, one of the safest drivers I've ever met in my entire life. Now, I, you know, it may be a conceit, you know, but I think I'm probably better, you know, in some crisis, extreme situations. You know, I rally biked a lot of things, a lot of experience of that, and good reflexes. But, however, you know, I've gotten a lot of car accidents too because I'm not really good at that other part, like driving consistently over a lifetime without bending everything.
Right. When it's intense, you're into it.
Right.
And yeah. And you'll be right at the edge, right? And every once in a while you'll go over, but of course you could not be good at the edge if you weren't at the edge, and you're not at the edge if occasionally you haven't gone over it.
Right. Well, but you know, my point though, the inverse is true. It's not that I'm lazy or you know, people like me are, it's just I'm not good. Damien is a better, is naturally intrinsically a better, safer driver. If you got him against, you know, he's your guy, right? You know, and you know, he could take a lot of rally courses and develop those skills. Maybe he'd be better than me, maybe not. Maybe I'm intrinsically good at that, but we're intrinsically good at different things, right? And that's to the point of Bob here, right? You know, or a pilot in a military service. It's not just about being able to make the thing go upside down. It's about being able to do it all the time, reliably.
But look at, you know, him as a ranger, right? The ability to adapt and overcome, right? I mean, you start to look at all of these, the combination of different things that he's made up of, and the difference between his history, how he grew up, and you know his grades in high school, and the reality of who he is just astonishing. You know, honesty. You know, it's so you think about a lot of people. You know, you think they're a little bit egotistical, right? They brag about themselves. They talk about themselves in that way. Bob just doesn't do that. I don't know whether he doesn't recognize how good he is at what he does, or if he's just, it's his nature, right? Or maybe it's that he's been in an environment with a whole bunch of other people who are awfully darn good at what they do. And he recognizes that he's just another one of however many thousand Rangers out there, and 100 who became pilots after that, and 10 who become, you know, training and hacking and, you know, hacker high school. Well, only one of those, but he doesn't recognize it in that ego way. He recognizes that in a desire to always do better.
Well, I'll argue that, it's setting different goals. You know, like if your goal is to be recognized, then that's when you get that recognition, you're done. If your goal is to be good, then you'll just keep working at that. Yeah, it is true across all disciplines. Artists, you know, you see, you know, actors, musicians, you know, people you think are, you know, phenomenally, you know, competent. And the really, really good ones aren't like, you're right, I'm great. They might say, you're right, I'm great at that. I'm actually really good at that, right? Now, I'm really happy with my thatness. However, there's all this other stuff. And if you see this one thing I did, you You didn't see that? That was horrible. I was appalled. You know, that even
thank goodness you didn't see it.
Right. Yeah, there is no, you know, any artist, you know, I don't specifically claim, well, I guess I do claim to be at the pinnacle of certain things, but, you know, but I don't see an end to them. There is no pinnacle. You know, yeah, over the top. Like, maybe as high as anyone's gotten so far, but there's always something else to figure out. There's always another level to get to. Right? If you want recognition, you know, get a job.
So one last thing he mentioned that I thought is fascinating. At that time, pilot was like the top job. You know, airline pilots were making, this is in like 1960, right? Airline pilots were making $140,000 a year. You know, you were rich, you were seeing the world, you were dressed nice, you know, you had what was then called a stewardess, not a flight attendant at the time. You know, and you know, travel in the world and the top of the top, right? Everybody's respecting you and saying, my God, there's a pilot, right? And now pilots are like the lowest paid on the totem pole. You got to struggle to get hours. It's like the, in the airline industry, you can probably get $15 an hour, maybe $20 an hour to be a pilot, but you won't get that many hours. Right. Until you're a real senior, you don't get your choice of routes. You're flying whatever plane they need you to fly. And it's not that it's a bad job. It's that it's such a difference between then and now. And sort of astonishing, right?
Everything has its time. You know, I have two cousins who are airline pilots. You know, they're both up around retirement age, you know, so they've been able to enjoy that, you know, that role. But you're right. You know, but some of these conversations over the decades stand out because, you know, when we're talking to Joey, you know, saying, you know, someday planes are going to be automated. And he's like, no, never. Right. He couldn't picture it. And he's, you know, a paper competent person, obviously, you know, flies the big jets. But I don't think he was kidding. I don't think he get, you know, because I said, I don't mean like tomorrow or even with our, you know, your career or in our lifetimes, but sooner or later they get automated and he couldn't believe in it. But we get to that point, right? You know, most practices and specialties have evolved, you know, and someone can call it and, you know, give some examples of some that don't, and that's wonderful. But, right, you know, these, you know, captain, these titles, you know, honorariums and so forth we give to airline pilots, you know, that didn't exist, you know, in 1850. And in 2050 or 2150, it may not be a thing either.
So are you saying that radio show host is going to be fully automated?
Well, I don't think so. You know, and this is, you know, since I was very, very young, I think about 7 years old, I remember having this train of thought, you know, with automation, robots and all the sci-fi stuff, you know, what's left for people to do. And I thought art, right? Art and creativity and so forth. And I spent a lot of my childhood working on that stuff and, you know, oddly got, you know, more on the engineering side in adulthood. And, you know, I felt bashful about it for decades. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, hippie kid, you know, sure, you'll all be better. No, I think that's it. I think when we, you know, automate all the stuff, you know, if I can have a 3D printed, you know, tactile, it feels real, looks real, it's the exact copy of a handmade craft mug that some human made for free, I would still pay $100 for the real one. Why? Because I'm a human. Humans like that sort of thing. I think waiters and you know, I think servers, you know, at restaurants in the long term, you know, 100, 200 years from now, you know, whatever, maybe sooner, but I think that ends up being a high paid job, a high paid skilled job. Because when you're going out, if eating is easy and automated and food, you know, all these sort of, you know, Star Trek future sort of things happen, then you want the experience. So it's really more of a human interaction thing, right? And I think we'll always pay for that. Humans like human things.
To slightly alter your quote, in the 1850s, there were no radio hosts. In the 1950s, there were. And the 2050s, maybe the 2150s, there won't be any more.
Maybe. Well, I think the human conversation and narrative, I watch what I consume, you know, like anything else. And, you know, I think forms and formats change, you know, delivery mechanisms. We're actually literally on the radio now because, you know, it suits our age category. But no, I think there will be this. I think content, you know, humans, you know, spending some time, you know, for many days, you know, listening to other humans talk about things will always be a thing. Always, always.
So when I was younger, the first radio station I worked at, WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech, in the 1970s, the early 1970s. And when I say work, I was a student, and it was, you know, the student station. And they had Clem, Carnegie's last engineering marvel. And Clem had, I think it was three tape machines, audio tape machines, and it had a digital system. It was designed by the engineers in electrical engineering at the school, and I was in electrical engineering at the school. And they designed Clem so that it was a redundant, resilient system to always have something on the air 24 hours, 7 days a week, including the commercials and the station breaks at the right times. And now, of course, every radio station runs that way. There are no longer disc jockeys that are sitting in the room real time. They occasionally do real time feeds and that sort of stuff, and they have equipment to help them do that, but it's all pre-programmed. And the way AI is going, I think it's reasonable to believe that we'll have generative AI that in real time can do a better job than we can on the radio station. And, you know, when it comes to BS, I don't think you can beat modern generative AI. I think it does that function even better than we do. And we're pretty impressive at it.
But I think that's just, you know, look, you know, what is the product? You know, is people consuming information in a human voice? Yeah, you know, AI can do that all day long. But, you know, already, right? You know, so with Instagram Reels, you know, I like those, you know, because I'm old, and, you know, Facebook is a thing for old folks. But anyways, you know, I can tell, I haven't really looked into this, but I'm sure, you know, that there's some AI tool in there that you can just give a text and it'll read the narration of your reel for you. And you use the same voice, you know, you recognize the same voice in different content creators and so forth, and you know it's not real. Now, can you make it more real? Make it sound more real to me? Sure. But it doesn't replace an actual person. Now,
but unless, it doesn't need to be real. It doesn't need to be an actual person. It needs to be entertaining.
Well, but that's, and again, that's where I'm getting to, you know, so just, if I just wanted to consume information, fine. But a lot of
it's not about entertainment, humans.
That's what
it's not about. No, it's not about consuming information. It's not about being human. It's about feeling humanity. And part of it is, let's just talk about humor. I'm pretty convinced that right now, if we wanted to, we could make automation better at creating jokes and telling jokes than I'll say 98% of all the comedians, including getting the right timing and all that stuff. Now, if you're going to do stand-up, you're going to need to be in front of a crowd, and we don't have that physical part of it really down yet. We could get there. But just doing it on the radio, I think we could do much better at that with the automated, you know, comedy creation and production and voice and all that stuff. In fact, not only that, we already have automated, for a long time, clapping and laughing and cheering. So, you know, part of the human reaction to comedy is laughing when other people laugh. That's what laugh tracks are all about, right? If you turn off the laugh track and watch a lot of sitcom, it's not that funny. But with the laugh track, you laugh at it. It's a cue as to what's funny and what to laugh at.
But even then, you know, and I haven't read studies, but I'm sure they're out there, and I'll predict what they say, you know, because, you know, after, I remember, you know, on What's My Line, I think it was, you know, a 70s game show, and it was the guy that invented the laugh track, which was new at the time, right? You know, it wasn't there at first, and then it was there. So I ended up growing up with the laugh track. And it was filmed before a live audience, which is different, because that's people laughing if things are funny. And these days, if you go back and listen to, you know, watch those shows and listen to that, you know, you can tell the difference, authentic and inauthentic. But if we go back to my coffee mug example, you know, again, I agree with everything you're saying. I think we can make systems that will make believable comedy, commentary, all sorts of things. And I think it will get, you know, it will get done and it will get consumed. But, you know, the premium value, whether it's, you know, what you're watching just when you really want to, you know, watch something, will be, for example, two human beings talking about a topic, you know, contemporaneously, right? You know, because, yeah, look at humor. I mean, particularly, you know, live comedy, right? Comedy is tragedy. And we learn to laugh. The first time a baby laughs is when they realize that something scary is a trick, right? I told this story on this show before. I'll tell it again. My daughter Roxanne, 2 months old or thereabouts, right? You know, I think even younger than that. But anyways, you know, there's that that moment where you go booga booga boo as a parent, and they do the startle reflex, the startle reflex, the startle reflex, and once you go booga boo boo, and they do a half of a startle reflex, and they smile or giggle or something like that first laugh. So you see how comedy works. It's something has to be at risk. Something's scary. Like, seriously, you know, that was, you know, I've been freaked out my entire life, the last 3 months since I was born. And I just realized we're sharing a moment here. You're messing with my head. You know my mechanisms, and you crawled inside my head and you pressed a button, and I know you did it, and you know I know, and I know you know I know. So that human.
Yep, and now I'm going to learn how to do it to you.
Right. Oh, yes, exactly. So I think that humanness is a perpetual thing, right? I don't think automation ever replaces that.
All right, look, I'm willing to make a bet. Let's say 50 years from now, if I'm right, 50 years from now, you'll give me $1.
All right.
And if I'm wrong, 50 years from now, I will give you $1.
All right. Fair enough.
I'm not sure. Is it legal to do this kind of betting on the air?
We're about to find out, aren't we? Sail it to port. See what happens.
Well, okay. I'll be properly afraid. Okay. You've heard it here. Chris Blast claiming that automation will take over everybody else's job, but not his.
That's right.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Vint Cerf is one of the best known early internet ARPANET developers, researchers, and one of the folks that's considered by many as one of the founders of the internet as it exists. He has continued to work over many years for a variety of companies and doing a variety of different work related to forming networks. Here's Vint.
We're back with Vint, and it's time for us to talk about the early days of the ARPANET. So you were there, as I understand it, at the very beginning of the ARPANET, before Node 1. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So what was it that got you from not the ARPANET to the ARPANET?
Well, it's several things. First of all, I was working with my thesis advisor, Jerry Estrin, and his work was sponsored by DARPA. And
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Advanced Research Projects Agency, which at the time was called ARPA, the Advanced Research
Which Project. Is Advanced Research Projects Agency. Right. We actually had a discussion with Rand Waltzman about DARPA versus ARPA and the changing of the names back and forth, which is fascinating, but we're not going to do it here.
A couple of times. Now it's DARPA pretty much permanently. So Jerry Estrin's work, part of that was this analyzing parallel programs or non-parallel programs to see whether they were parallelizable. That project eventually went away, and ARPA handed over a different project to Leonard Kleinrock, who was also on my thesis committee. But his business was modeling of store and forward networks. He'd done his dissertation work at MIT in 61, 62, came to UCLA in 62, and has been there ever since. He's been.
So before you rush off, store and forward networks, what was the first store and forward network that you're aware of that you worked on?
Actually, the ARPANET was the first one that I encountered anyway.
Okay, because there were store and forward networks before that.
Yes, if you push this a little, message switching is a store and forward process. And Kleinrock, in fact, analyzed message switching as his dissertation, but the statistics of message switching and packet switching are not terribly different. And so the same kinds of mathematical methods apply. He had broken the back of the state explosion problem by doing a very clever trick. In a store and forward network, normally you generate something from some distribution of the packet size that was, you know, generated at some origin, and it's going to go through the network somehow, hop by hop. And in the ordinary models, you would try to track a particular packet all the way through the system. But that meant the statistics were now sensitive to which packet went through which node and at what time and in what order.
Yeah,
and that, you know, the state space blew up, and the So
you sort of almost need to use queuing theory here.
Yeah, that's exactly what this is. That is queuing theory. And so the Markov model had too many states in it. So he did something very clever. He said, okay, the packet arrives at the next node. And instead of remembering what the packet size was, instead, let's draw from the same distribution that was used to generate that packet from the previous node. Let's just draw another random packet.
Sure, of course. Yeah. Instead of routing each one in sequence, you just pick a random one to route, and it all falls out. It's no statistical problem. Analysis is quick and efficient. And now, of course, there are going to be cases where you're at the edge of bad sequencing and things go wrong, but you're going to get the mean information pretty quickly.
Well, we're not paying any attention at all to any delivery or assurance of delivery or retransmission or anything else. It's just, what's the store and forward rate? You know, is it congested? What's the average? What are the moments of the distribution of delay? What's the optimal throughput through a collection of nodes with a particular topography and with a particular data rate? So he was also looking at the capacity assignment problem. Given a matrix of demand, how much data, where is it coming from, and where is it going to? You could figure out what's the optimal topology, or you could figure out what's the optimal capacity assignment to carry that traffic load. So anyway, Len ends up being the head of the network measurement center that ARPA decides to set up in anticipation of building a packet switch network called the ARPANET. And so I end up working in Len's lab as the principal programmer for the Network Measurement Center. The first node of the ARPANET gets delivered to UCLA in September of 1969 after about 9 months of work by Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, the company that won the contract to build the packet switches of the ARPANET. They call those interface message processors, or IMPs. And so we got our first one around Labor Day in 1969. The first four nodes of the net were completed by January of 1970. SRI International was the second. The third was UC Santa Barbara, and the fourth one was University of Utah. So we had a four-node network, and that's my first encounter with the ARPANET.
And then how big was it over the next couple of years?
It got bigger to by 70 nodes or so. And by the time 1973 rolls around, we've got nodes in Norway and London, for example, that are linked in by a satellite hop between the U.S. and Norway, and then a landline down to University College London.
Yeah, I was a systems operator on the node at Carnegie Mellon University in the early 1970s. So,
wow, how about that?
It was very interesting because you could connect to DISN as well. So Defense Information Systems Network, because they had a node in, I guess it was in Germany at some point, where there was a place there. And so you would talk to the night operator in Germany, but it wasn't directly connected. You could type him a message and he would go and type it in to the other network.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's a different story. We did eventually have a German node up. It was in Landstuhl, I think.
Yeah, it was in the early 70s. I mean, I don't remember the exact. Yeah. All right, excellent. So that's the ARPANET. So what did you do in the early days of the ARPANET besides measurement? What was your function and your contribution?
Well, I had two particular functions. First was running the Network Measurement Center's software development for Len Kleinrock, capturing data and comparing that to the models that Kleinrock students had put together. Con and I worked very closely on that together while he was at ARPA and I was he was at BBNN at the time and I was at UCLA. But then I had another role working with Steve Crocker. Crocker ran the network working group that developed the host level software for the ARPANET.
We're going to take a break here and we're going to talk about that. We're into the beginning of the ARPANET. And he's talking about store and forward networks. But before we get to that, there are these phrases that people use. And this is just a classic. He had broken the back of the such and such problem, right?
Right.
It is, quite literally a struggle. it's a battle, a fight, a hand-to-hand combat against these problems. And when somebody figures it out after a whole bunch of people have been trying, that's how they describe it. And it reminds me of a quote from Alan Perlis. I think I might have talked about it on the show before. Problems worthy of attack prove their worth by fighting back. He was an early Turing Award winner. And those are the problems that are fun. Those are the ones that are worth doing, right? Because the easy ones, you solve them. It takes 5 minutes or however many minutes and it's done. But these tricky ones, these are the ones that they found some clever trick. They worked their way around it. Maybe they had 15 or 20 problems that they hit along the way, and they finally found the magic trick that solved it. In this case, it was a statistical approach and getting rid of some assumptions. But I want to point out that those statistical sorts of analysis are why it is that people like me can successfully break into computer systems. Okay, because their statistics makes these assumptions, right? It says, well, you know, the particular sequence doesn't matter. We're only trying to find throughput in this thing and the other thing. We're not worried about the particular sequencing. And attackers say, well, what if I create a sequence that overloads something, right? So I can make it so that I send a little one here and a big one there, and I put them out of order. And all of a sudden on the other end, it's thrashing. It's spending lots and lots of time and enormous amounts of space, and it can no longer do anything else because it's trying to solve this trick problem I gave it, but I intentionally gave it to cause it to be disrupted. And so you see this all the time, these assumptions that people make to be able to do these calculations, because the problems are actually harder than the ones that they know how to solve. So they end up using these tricks to solve the problems. They get something working really well, and it seems to work great until somebody clever comes along and says, yeah, but what if I do this? And that, I just love that part of the hacking game.
It is. And, you know, we all know the old trope about a butterfly flaps its wings in Kansas, you know, which inevitably leads to a typhoon in Singapore. But it's more than that, like most things. You know, that's true enough. But, you know, you start to realize, and this is where I get my whole inevitability curve inclination, right? Because there are times, you know, like with network address translation, for me in the first time, you know, that I can really point to, and you know, what Vin's talking about and what you're talking about, there are times when a lot of butterflies are trying to, you know, flap their wings. And to be clear, these aren't butterflies. They're human beings. And, you know, which is such an advanced complexity. Right. And you start focusing, and particularly have a large population like we have, you know, in modern times, you know, just randomly, you know, or you know, pseudo randomly, right? You know, you have some population of human beings who are doing exactly what you said. Just, you know, every day, you know, that I sail these boats around, I'm navigating around. Right now I'm studying this area in the Indian River Lagoon, which means moving the boats to a spot, watching the tides go up and down, you know, a lot of it very shallow water. Where can I navigate? Where can I not? You know, bumping up and getting stuck, you know, while moving, and then spinning the boats, you know, to free them up before I get, you know, is the exact same desire you're talking about. You know, a lot of people, you know, and some of us, you know, rather obsessively, you know, everybody involved in this, you know, episode, you know, love that challenge, love that problem. It's like, you know, why is this not working? Why isn't that working? And individuals can do amazing things all the time. But, you know, everybody, you know, we've had on this whole series, and most of the people we know, you know, in this industry, you know, are doing things that have outsized ramifications that ripple around the world in various ways. And it's not just the Vint Cerfs and the Fred Cohens and whoever, right? You know, that's one of the fascinating things, you know, fascinating things about this industry for me is meeting now young folks, you know, getting into it and watching what they're doing, right? And by my standards now, young is like 35 years old. People running companies, raising hundreds of millions of dollars, changing the world. And whether or not that their company survives, you know, 50 years, their impact will. And, you know, the people will be doing shows like this and saying, you know, if that thing you see or don't see, like lift the corner underneath the hood, that's because this person in, you know, 1987 or 1973 or, you know, 2024 or 2025 did this thing. And it's just amazing. It's just this fabric of efforts all interweaving, right? This internet, you know, this the cliche of this interconnected, you know, minds, you know, really is instantiated in the real world, in the bloody network itself. It's a bunch of people. It's a bunch of ripples from people's actions, you know, that have, you know, optimized, you know, certain things get interesting at certain times. A lot of us flap our wings, you know, we, you know, one of us comes up with something, and that thing, you know, just goes on forever. And the ripples of everyone involved, right? You know, everything that happens stays happened, right? You know, and those are real artifacts in time, and their effects are what, you know, guide the future. It's amazing.
Yeah, this is part of that ratcheting effect that you tend to talk about, right? So, the problem, one of the many problems, not like we're running out of them, is that, you know, we build a house of cards and then we try and live in it. And then everybody living in the house of cards wants to build their own house of cards, and then somebody tries to live in that. And, you know, basically, if you don't have that solid foundation, you know, you're building on mud. And, you know, so you build this thing on mud, and what you've made is also similarly imperfect. So it's made of mud, and eventually all the mud just collapses. And we notion that that's going to happen. And we see it happening all the time. I mean, we just saw the AT&T outage. I think it was AT&T, right? In the last, you know, week or three or whatever.
Sounds right. And, there's always one.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't have the details of it, but it doesn't matter. We're just going to assume that what they said is true, that somebody made a mistake, right, in some software update that took out all of that network, the entire nationwide AT&T cellular network for the better part of a day. Okay, on a weekday. Now, you may say, well, yeah, but it's not that important and it's not that much money and so forth. And I'm going to tentatively agree with you on that, except for one thing. So I just pushed out my March article called MFU Multi-Factor Foul-Up. Now, yeah, I used the word foul. You know, I was using foul language, but appropriately foul language. And so now think about all the multi-factor stuff that goes through cell phones. Now, AT&T is what, maybe 25%? Of all of the cellular traffic in the U.S., maybe more, maybe, I don't know the exact.
Oh, yeah, of course, you're right. That's right.
So everybody that was trying to access, yeah, everybody trying to access anything or make a payment or get into their bank account, the multi-factor process, yeah, it said, oh, send a text to their cell phone. Well, guess what?
And as you know, I get at edges, you know, where 5G fails and my cell phone will fail. You know, coverage is not ubiquitous, and I see that one myself. You know, but you're right, on a national scale, that's a big hit. But I gotta say, you know, I think that, you know, my optimism at this point, you know, we can see it all through human history. You go to Cairo, right? You know, the go to Egypt, and there's the Bent Pyramid. You know, that as I learned it, you know, maybe archaeology has changed, but don't think so. I think the story is still contemporary. But the you know, the Bent Pyramid, you know, rises at a steeper angle than all the other ones we're familiar with, up to a certain point, and then it bends in and arrives at a less angle. And as I learned it, it's because, you know, some pharaoh said, "All right, you know, I want mine to be bigger and taller and steeper." And he found an architect who would say yes, and no, stone does not have an infinite crushing point, and you just met the math. Yeah, maybe that brought down his, you know, culture. Maybe that was an end of a, you know, that was a, you know, national, you know, disaster and so forth. However, you know, later on, you know, people figured out what does work and built the pyramids, have been there for 3,500 years.
So
we get there in the end. It doesn't mean we don't make some stupid pyramids, right? But we almost inevitably have to at some point. Otherwise, how do you find the limit?
So you know the way I am. I did a back of the envelope calculation. So what's the US GDP? Any sense of what that is?
I had not offhand. I knew that number just recently. I looked that up for some reason.
Yeah. It's something like $1 trillion a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe more, maybe less, whatever it is. So if it's $1 trillion a day, then that one day, suppose AT&T is only involved in 25% of the sales and transactions and other activities, you know, their cellular network. So that's only $250 billion per day. So, okay, now, I don't know if you know the statistics on cybercrime losses, the damage from cybercrime, but I think the current claims, let's see, according to the FBI, it was something on the order of $7 billion in 2021 or something, maybe doubling every year. So So the we're talking about $10 or $20 billion is the total loss from cyber attacks. And on that one day, the disruption to commerce was an order of magnitude larger because multi-factor authentication. And so what's the purpose of multi-factor authentication? It's to reduce the negative consequences associated with cyber attacks of one particular sort exploiting one particular mechanism. And in that day, probably more was lost, more damage occurred than the entire cybersecurity consequences of losses of everything in the country per year.
Well, and in this, you know, that lines up, you know, again with my point about, you know, embedded technologies, right? You know, that, you know, as you know, this one, I'm always ranting about the fact that telephony, like you talk to anybody, you know, talk to the non-techies, right? You know, people who just, you know, use a smartphone because they're, you know, it's part of their lives. And what is the one app nobody uses? The phone. You know, there's like three people on earth that I get phone calls from on the telephone, right? And then there's this text thing, this SMS thing, and multi-factor authentication, which is, while it's very handy, as I experienced in my own life, sometimes your cell phone just doesn't work, and now you can't authenticate, right? And I got an internet connection, I got Starlink and everything's fine, but I can't get a blade text, right? You know, and there's apps, you know, that work or don't work based on the fact that a phone is, you know, still, you know, psychologically, you know, from an engineering perspective, this 1947 system where there's literally a physical copper path between here and there, right? And that's not the actual technical case anymore, but it's practically, pragmatically, you know, good enough that in 2024, multi-factor authentication text to your phone, we all use it. It's really handy. It's the best way to do it. It actually works. If I got my phone and I get it, that's pretty good. But what if I don't? Or what if I have one of the other 17 bloody devices I use all the time and not my actual quote-unquote telephone?
Well, the disruption is worse than the consequences of not having the added protection.
Right.
So it's a bad trade-off.
Right.
But we don't have any choice. Not only that, we're moving further in that direction.
Well, but it's a Ben Pyramid moment. You know, this you know, that particular event will resonate with a lot of people for a while, right? That'll start to bend curves away from, right? You know, just like invention, you know, usual catastrophic events aren't really the cause of something. They're the catalyst. You know, things have been building up for a while. And this sort of fragility is an issue that you and I and everybody we know has discussed a lot. And it's, you know, these sort of things get it further outside the box, right?
Yeah, but I don't get to say I told you so, right? What I really want is a huge microphone so that whenever something happens that I warned about and it happens whenever it happens later, I push a button and everybody in the world that had the other position gets the message, I told you so, you know?
Right. Well, you because, know, the sort of forecasters and futurists like us, you know, we all appreciate that Jaws clip. Right, you know, where Richard Dreyfuss is standing on the dock and everybody's going out to get the reward for, you know, the sharks. There's like 17 guys on this little boat. He's like, you're all gonna die. smiling and wave. Thanks. Yeah, sometimes you just gotta see it coming. It's like, all right, right, okay. Well, and I think it's part of my nature. It's like usually when a disaster happens, I'm not freaking out because, you know, you sort of see it coming, right? You know, isn't it true? I mean, doesn't most people see this? Like, oh, okay, so this has happened, right? Just even a car accident. It's like I'm driving cars. The fact that they're going to get bent and something's going to go wrong is kind of there. So when it happens, you're like, all right, you already thought this through. Start dealing with the aftermath.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is when you actually get in those accident situations, your mind runs faster. So you have this time warp. So it's that slow motion train wreck that you see coming and you can't do anything about. And you're just looking at it and saying, oh, man, this is going to hurt.
Well, yeah,
which brings me to a song, which I think we'll probably overplay on this. What is it?
Fusion, transfusion. No, Doc, pardon me for this crazy intrusion. I'm never, never, never going to speed again. Pump the fluid in me, Louie.
So the only other thing I wanted to talk about in this particular one was store and forward, but we're going to store that for the next conversation.
The next segment.
Go forward. Yeah, yeah.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on the Cyber Show, Bob gets mad to the point of going nowhere, which was the goal. Vint works on TCP leading to BP for IP before there even was an I in TCP.
Hmm. Aizen turns the corner, starts to climb, and hits zero. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.